Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're diving into linear elastic fracture mechanics.
Ooh, sounds intense.
It is, but fascinating too, I promise. We've got three academic papers here. And get this, the math they use to predict how cracks act. Sometimes it says crack lips should overlap.
Wait, what? How's that even possible?
Exactly. That's what we're going to figure out. How do researchers handle this overlapping lips thing? And what's it tell us about the limits of using theoretical models to explain real-world things?
Makes you wonder how much we can really trust those models, huh?
Right. We'll also look at how stress around a crack compares to an intact plate.
Does a crack actually weaken material as much as we think?
That's the question. Get ready for some surprises. It's not always what you'd expect.
I'm intrigued already.
Okay, so first things first, gotta define a key concept. The mathematical crack. What's that all about?
So basically, a mathematical crack is a straight crack, but we pretend its lips are zero distance apart. It's just an idea, a simplification to make analysis easier.
Ah, so not a perfect picture of a real crack, just a starting point.
Exactly. And this idea leads to the paradox of overlapping lips. These papers look at the classic solution for an infinite plate. Got a mathematical crack in it under stress.
Okay, I'm following so far.
Now, for certain combos of stress, the math says those crack lips should overlap. But in the real world, that's impossible.
Like parts of the material passing through each other. That's wild.
Right. Shows how theoretical models can give results that contradict reality. The researchers use this plexiglass plate, infinite, they say, with specific dimensions and stress values, and these biaxiality ratios.
Biaxiality, what now?
It describes the balance of stresses in different directions, affects the crack shape.
So they're testing when the model breaks down, right?
Exactly. Some stress conditions give you a normal open crack, but change the stress values, the biaxiality ratios, boom, overlapping lips. This is where stress intensity factors, or SIFs, come in. They measure how intense stress is near a crack tip.
Basically, how much stress is focused at the very tip of the crack.
Yep. And the overlapping lips thing leads to a negative modi stress intensity factor.
Negative. So the stress is trying to push the crack closed. That doesn't make sense.
Exactly. Shows how nonsensical a classic solution can be sometimes. There's even a graph in the paper showing these negative SIF values. But these weird results, they actually give us clues. Show us we need a new approach. Enter the inverse problem.
Okay, so now we're tweaking the model to match reality, right?
Exactly. With the inverse problem, researchers apply an opposite displacement field, basically a counterforce, to stop the overlap, like pushing those overlapping lips back where they should be.
Clever.
They modify specific terms in the displacement equations, keep others that represent natural crack behavior.
So they're carefully fixing the overlap without messing up the rest of the model.
Precisely. And this change brings in contact stresses.
Contact stresses. Is that like the force that actually stops crack lips from overlapping in the real world?
Bingo. The model now knows those lips can't pass through each other. And it includes the forces that happen when they touch. And here's a kicker. These contact stresses depend on the material's compliance. Stiffer materials need higher contact stresses to stop the overlap.
So a stiff material fights back harder against overlapping, like it doesn't want to change shape.
Exactly. Now they combine the original problem with its potential overlapping and this inverse problem to make a general problem solution.
So a best of both worlds kind of thing.
Exactly. This general problem solution works for both open and closed cracks. Considers all the states a crack can be in. And for closed cracks with friction between the lips, the SIFs become zero.
Wait, zero. So no stress at the tip of a closed crack?
Not quite. When the lips are touching and there's friction, you don't have that sharp stress concentration at the tip. The stress spreads out more evenly. So the general problem solution, by including contact and friction, gives a much more accurate, realistic picture of how cracks act.
Wow, this is getting pretty deep. We've talked about infinite plates, which are theoretical, right? What about finite plates? Something more like what we see in the real world.
That's where things get even more interesting. They compared a cracked finite plate under uniaxial compression to an intact plate under the same load. Uniaxial compression just means squeezing the plates from top to bottom.
Got it. So comparing how a plate with a crack squishes compared to a solid plate.
Exactly. And guess what? The displacement fields, meaning how the material deforms, they converge really fast away from the crack. Even with high stress, the cracked and intact plates deform almost the same as you move away from the crack.
That's kind of surprising. I think a crack would mess things up more, spread out the effect.
Right. But it seems a crack's impact on deformation is way more localized than we think, especially with friction involved.
So what happens near the crack? Is it all the same there?
Not quite. Near the crack, especially without friction, there are some key differences. For example, the stresses near the crack are much higher compared to the intact plate. They also found that the crack lips, besides maybe opening, can rotate and slide against each other.
So the crack isn't just a static line, it's like a moving part that changes how the material reacts to stress.
Precisely. Now let's go back to those contact stresses. They compared those stresses, the ones preventing overlap, to stresses at the same spots in an intact plate.
So comparing the same points in both plates, cracked and intact.
Yep. And here's the kicker. The contact stresses in the cracked plate, always higher than the matching stresses in the intact plate.
Always. That means the crack's actually creating more stress in those contact areas. I thought cracks were supposed to relieve stress, not make it worse.
Right. It's counterintuitive. They looked specifically at uniaxial compression perpendicular to the crack, meaning squeezing the plate from the sides at a right angle to the crack. In this case, both the classic LEFM solution, which gave us those overlapping lips, and the general problem solution predict a zero-mode ISIF.
But don't they get there for different reasons?
You got it. The classic solution gets zero because of the impossible overlapping. The general problem solution gets zero because it forces the lips to be in full contact, meaning no stress concentration at the tip. And this ties back to those higher contact stresses. The cracked plate, even though similar to the intact plate away from the crack, needs more stress along those cracked lips to keep them together, to prevent them from magically passing through each other.
So even if the crack seems like a local thing, it forces the material to work harder in those contact zones.
Exactly. Shows how important material properties are.
This is really changing how I picture cracks. It's not just a line. It's a whole zone where stress acts differently.
You got it. And this understanding is key to figuring out how cracks behave under stress and designing stuff that can handle it.
Okay, we've talked mode I loading, where crack lips are pulled apart. What about mode II, where they're sheared, sliding against each other?
Ah, that's where things get tricky experimentally. Turns out getting pure mode II loading is super hard. Like sliding two blocks perfectly without lifting or pushing them.
Sounds like a challenge.
It is. And this difficulty creates some gaps between what theories predict and what actually happens in labs. For instance, the classic LEFM solutions, the ones with those overlapping lips, always predict overlap for pure mode II. But once we factor in contact stresses, things change.
So the general problem solution saves the day again.
Right on. It makes the lips touch completely, so no overlap, and gives a more realistic picture of how cracks act under mode II.
So the general problem seems to win every time, being more realistic.
Yeah, it shows how important it is to keep refining our models based on what we see in experiments. Theory and observation got to work together.
Okay, why are researchers so obsessed with this pure mode II loading anyway? What's the big deal?
Well, one reason, it's the main way cracks grow in certain materials, like composites.
Composites? You mean like the stuff in airplanes and wind turbine blades?
Exactly. Those layered structures are more prone to cracks growing under shear, the layers sliding past each other. Understanding mode II is key for designing strong composite stuff.
Makes sense. It's not just how cracks grow, but how they grow in specific materials under specific conditions.
Right. Plus, mode II loading can be more unpredictable and potentially more dangerous than mode I.
Hold on, aren't all cracks kind of dangerous by default?
Sure, but mode II cracks grow more predictably, making it easier to know which way they'll go and how fast. But mode II, they can be erratic, making design tougher.
So a mode II crack is like a wild card. You don't know which way it'll jump.
Pretty much. It's all about how stress concentrates around the crack tip.
Okay, let's break that down. How does stress concentration affect crack growth in mode II?
See, in mode I, the highest stress is right ahead of the tip. Like pulling a paper with a tear, the tear goes straight ahead. But in mode II, the highest stress is off to the sides of the tip, at an angle.
So instead of going straight, the crack could go sideways, curve around unpredictably.
Exactly. Makes it much harder to predict, hence all the interest in mode II. Yep. If we figure out this complex, potentially dangerous type of crack growth, we can design stuff that's way safer.
Right, like you wouldn't want a bridge to have a mode II crack that suddenly decides to grow sideways.
Exactly. That's why researchers are working so hard to isolate pure mode II loading in their experiments. It lets them zoom in on this specific kind of crack growth and check if their theories hold up.
But didn't you say it's super hard to get that pure mode II loading in a lab setting?
It is. It's like trying to do brain surgery on a roller coaster.
Mm.
Any tiny mistake and your results are messed up.
Yikes, that's a scary thought.
Right. But despite the difficulty, researchers have come up with clever ways to get close to pure Mo2 loading. One way is using specially shaped specimens, designed to focus shear stresses at the crack tip without other stresses getting in the way.
So they're making the crack grow in a controlled way so they can study it better.
Precisely. And they also use super precise loading systems that apply force very carefully. It's all about control and precision.
So it's a combo of smart design and high-tech equipment.
You got it. And by using these techniques, they've made big progress in understanding Mo2 cracks and refining our theoretical models of this whole phenomenon.
This deep dive has really blown my mind. It's amazing how much there is to know about cracks, stresses, and how materials behave.
There's a whole hidden world, right? And we've only just scratched the surface.
Well, I'm hooked. Now, we talked about how those theoretical models can be wrong, like with those impossible overlapping crack lips. But what about those stress neutralization techniques the researchers use? They sounded pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, those are really interesting. It's a prime example of how we can use math to solve real-world problems in fracture mechanics. Basically, the idea is to introduce a second stress field that cancels out or neutralizes the stress in a specific part of the material.
Like using a negative stress field to create a zone of zero stress.
Exactly. In these papers, they use this technique to create those parabolic cracks we talked about before. But instead of actually cutting or drilling those cracks, they did it all with math by manipulating the stress fields.
So virtual crack creation, they're using equations to sculpt the stress field into the shape they want.
You got it. These stress neutralization techniques are super powerful for analyzing complex crack shapes and understanding how they affect the way stress is spread out within a structure.
Man, my brain is doing backflips. We've covered so much ground: overlapping lips, contact stresses, Mo2 loading, material properties, crack shape, and now stress neutralization techniques.
And we're just getting started.
I know, right? It's like a crash course in advanced fracture mechanics.
You're picking it up quickly, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really enjoying it, but I do have a more practical question. We've talked about how cracks form and behave, but what can we actually do about them? How do engineers deal with the risks of cracks and prevent things from, you know, breaking catastrophically?
That's a great question, and it brings us to the idea of crack management and damage tolerance.
Damage tolerance, is that like designing things to handle some damage without falling apart completely?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a big deal in modern engineering. The idea is that cracks are going to happen. We can't stop them completely. So we got to design things that can handle them without compromising safety.
So it's a more realistic approach, acknowledging that there will be imperfections.
Precisely. Damage tolerance needs a deep understanding of fracture mechanics. It relies on complex models and analyses to predict how cracks will grow and ensure things stay strong, even with some damage already there.
So it's about using the right materials, designing smart structures, and having good inspection and maintenance to catch cracks early on.
You got it. And this approach is becoming even more crucial as we create more complex and lighter structures that push the limits of material science.
This deep dive has been eye-opening. It's made me realize that fracture mechanics is a really important part of keeping us safe.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating and dynamic field. And as we wrap up this part of our exploration, I think it's safe to say that we've busted the myth that all cracks are bad.
Right. Sometimes cracks are there to make things stronger and more resilient.
Exactly. Understanding how cracks work and how to manage them is key to building a world that's both innovative and safe.
Couldn't have said it better myself. But there's still so much more to explore. In part 3 of this deep dive, we'll get into the nitty-gritty of stress intensity factors and how they're used to predict crack growth and check the strength of materials.
Stay tuned. We're going even deeper into the world of cracks, stresses, and the science of keeping our built environment safe and sound.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're still digging into cracks and stresses, and now I'm curious, how does a crack's shape, like its actual geometry, affect how it behaves?
Oh, that's a great question. The geometry of a crack makes a big difference. It's
yeah.
not just about whether they're ireth, a crack. It's about the specifics.
Okay, so let's break it down. How does the length of a crack matter?
Well, think about a sheet of paper with a tiny tear and another with a long tear. The one with a longer tear, it's going to rip easier, right? It's weaker.
Yeah, makes sense. Longer crack, bigger weak spot.
Exactly. And longer cracks tend to have more stress concentrated at the tip, which, remember, makes them grow faster.
So longer crack, faster growth, more dangerous. Got it. What about depth? Does that matter?
Absolutely. Deeper cracks, especially the ones that go most of the way through the material, those are more serious than shallow ones. Think of it like a deep cut on your skin versus a scratch.
Ouch, yeah, that makes sense. A deep crack would weaken the whole thing way more.
Right. It really affects how much load the material can handle and how well it resists further damage.
Okay, length, depth. What about the shape of the crack? Does that play a role?
Definitely. The shape can have a big impact. Sharp, pointy cracks concentrate stress more than rounded ones.
So a sharp crack's like a knife, and a rounded one's like a, I don't know, a blunt object pushing through.
Yeah, that's a good way to visualize it. And this difference in stress concentration, it affects how fast the crack grows A and D, which direction it goes. Sharp cracks grow faster, more predictably. Rounded cracks, they can be more stable, grow slower.
So the shape of the crack kind of guides how the stress flows through the material.
Exactly. Engineers have to think about what kinds of cracks might form and how they'll behave under different stresses.
Gotcha. So we've got length, depth, shape. What about orientation? Like, does it matter which way the crack's pointing relative to the force being applied?
Oh, absolutely. That's a huge factor. Let's say we have a crack in a plate. If it's perpendicular to the force, like pulling a sheet of paper with a tear across the width, it's more vulnerable to Modi loading, that pulling apart we talked about.
Right, because the force is pulling directly on the crack, trying to open it up.
Exactly. But with Mode 2, that shearing, the orientation gets trickier. It's not as simple as one way being better or worse.
So it's more about how the shear force interacts with that specific crack angle.
You got it. We got to consider all these things together. Length, depth, shape, orientation, AD, the type of loading, to figure out the risk of crack growth.
Wow, this is making me realize how interconnected everything is in fracture mechanics. It's like all these pieces working together to determine how a crack will behave.
It really is. And understanding this interplay is what allows engineers to design stuff that can handle those forces and stay safe and reliable.
Now, these papers we're looking at, they focused on parabolic cracks, right? Why that specific shape?
They used those parabolic cracks to model a real-world crack shape called a rounded V-notch.
Rounded V-notch. So like a V-shape, but with a rounded tip instead of a sharp point.
Exactly. These rounded notches are pretty common because they actually help reduce stress concentrations.
So it's like intentionally creating a weak spot, but one that's less likely to cause problems than a sharp crack.
Exactly. The parabolic shape is a good mathematical model for those rounded notches so that researchers could analyze how they behave and how they affect stress distribution.
So they're using these ideal parabolic cracks to learn about the real-world notches. What did they find out about the stresses around those cracks?
Well, like we saw with straight cracks, the parabolic crack had the biggest impact near its tip, where the stress was most concentrated.
Makes sense. That's where the material is feeling the most force.
Right. But as you moved further away from the notch tip, the stress field started to look more like what you'd see in a normal, intact plate.
So again, the effect of the notch is mostly localized, even though it's changing how stress is distributed.
Exactly. And this is a key finding. It tells us that notches, even though they create those stress hotspots, don't necessarily weaken the whole structure, especially if they're designed well and placed strategically.
So it's all about managing those stress concentrations, making sure they don't lead to crack growth.
Precisely. And this is where understanding fracture mechanics is so important. It gives engineers the knowledge to design things that can handle those stresses and stay strong, even with those intentional notches.
Speaking of intentional design, those stress neutralization techniques you mentioned before, they really piqued my curiosity. Can you unpack those a bit more?
Sure. It's a really cool example of using math to solve tricky problems in fracture mechanics. The basic idea is you add another stress field that basically cancels out or neutralizes the stresses in a particular spot in the material.
So like adding a negative stress field on top of the existing one to create a zone of zero stress.
Exactly. And in these papers, they use this to mathematically make those parabolic notches without actually changing the material physically.
That's mind-blowing. It's like virtual material removal. They're using equations to sculpt the stress field into the shape they want.
You got it. These techniques are super powerful for studying complex crack shapes and seeing how they affect the stress distribution.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about how cracks act, their shape, and even how researchers are using fancy math to study them. But what about real-world applications? What can engineers actually DO to prevent things from breaking?
That's a great question. And it leads us to this really important concept called damage tolerance.
Damage tolerance. So designing things to be able to handle some damage without completely failing.
Exactly. It's a key idea in modern structural engineering. We accept that cracks and flaws are going to happen. We can't always prevent them. So we design things to tolerate them safely.
So it's more realistic, acknowledging that nothing's perfect.
Precisely. Damage tolerance requires us to really understand fracture mechanics. We use sophisticated models and analyses to predict how those cracks will grow and make sure the structure stays safe, even with existing damage.
So it's about using the right materials, designing smart structures, and having good inspection and maintenance programs to catch cracks early.
You got it. And this approach is even more important now as we build more complex and lightweight structures, pushing the boundaries of material science.
This deep dive has been a real eye-opener. It's made me see how important fracture mechanics is for safety and reliability.
It's a fascinating field, that's for sure. And as we wrap up this part, I think we can confidently say that cracks aren't always the villains we make them out to be.
Right. Sometimes cracks actually make things stronger and tougher.
Exactly. It's all about understanding how they work and how to manage them. That's the key to building a world that's both innovative and safe.
Now, switching gears a bit, I want to dig into those material properties we touched on earlier. They seem to play a big role in how cracks act. Can you talk more about how things like strength, stiffness, and toughness affect how a material responds to cracks?
Of course. Material properties are absolutely fundamental to fracture mechanics. Let's start with strength. Strength basically means how much stress a material can handle before it permanently deforms or breaks.
So a high-strength material can take more abuse before it gives in.
Exactly. When it comes to cracks, a material's strength determines how much stress is needed to start a crack or make an existing one grow. A weak material will crack more easily and won't handle as much stress before those cracks become a problem.
Okay, that makes sense. What about stiffness? Where does that fit in?
Stiffness is how much a material resists deformation under stress. Think of it like how springy or rigid something is. A stiff material, like a steel beam, is hard to bend, while a less stiff material, like a rubber band, bends easily.
Okay, I get the picture. But how does stiffness affect crack behavior?
Well, one important thing is that stiffer materials tend to concentrate stress more around cracks. They don't give as much, so the stress is built up more quickly around those weak points.
But wouldn't a stiffer material also be stronger and therefore better at resisting cracks?
Ah, that's a common misunderstanding. Strength and stiffness aren't always directly related. You can have materials that are stiff but not strong, and vice versa.
So something might be hard to bend, but it could snap easily if you pull on it too hard.
Exactly. That's why both strength and stiffness matter when we're thinking about cracks. Now let's talk about toughness. Toughness is all about a material's ability to absorb energy before it fractures.
Sounds like a measure of how much punishment a material can take before it breaks.
That's a good way to put it. Toughness is about how much energy it takes to make a crack grow. So a tough material resists crack growth, even if it's not super strong or stiff.
So toughness is about absorbing energy and stopping a crack from spreading easily.
Exactly. A tough material can take a hit, literally, and dissipate that energy so the crack doesn't grow as much.
This is really interesting. Strength, stiffness, and toughness are all playing a role in this whole crack behavior thing. It's like finding the right balance between those properties to handle the stresses.
Absolutely. And it's not just about the material itself. Designing structures that minimize stress concentrations and can tolerate some flaws is crucial too.
Right. It's a holistic approach, thinking about both the materials and the design. You know, another thing that stuck with me throughout this deep dive is the importance of those contact stresses. They're clearly a bigger deal than I initially realized.
You're right. Understanding how those contact stresses affect crack behavior is super important for designing safe and reliable structures.
Okay, let's revisit contact stresses one more time. Can you remind me what they are and why they're so important when we talk about cracks?
Sure. Contact stresses are simply the forces that happen when two surfaces press against each other. In fracture mechanics, we're mainly interested in the contact stresses between the lips of a crack.
Right, because those crack lips can't actually pass through each other, even though those classic models sometimes say they do.
Exactly. When those lips touch, they push on each other, and that creates contact stresses. Those stresses act like an internal brace, trying to hold the crack together and stop it from growing.
So they're working against the forces that are trying to pull the crack open.
Exactly. How strong those contact stresses are depends on things like the applied load, the crack shape, and, as we've been discussing, the material properties.
Right. Those material properties, strength, stiffness, toughness, they all determine how much those crack lips push back. And didn't we learn that those contact stresses can actually be higher than the stresses in a similar spot in a normal intact plate?
That's right. It seems counterintuitive at first, right? It's like the crack is concentrating stress in those contact areas, even if the stress further away is normal.
So even if the crack seems like a localized thing, it makes the material work harder in those specific spots.
Precisely. It's kind of like trying to hold two slippery blocks together while someone's pulling them apart. You have to grip them really hard to keep them from slipping, and the harder you grip, the more force you're putting on those contact points.
That's a great analogy. It makes sense that those contact zones would have higher stress because they're basically doing the heavy lifting of keeping the crack from spreading.
Exactly. And to understand why this happens, we need to think about how the material deforms when it's under stress and how the crack messes with that normal deformation.
Okay, let's walk through that. Imagine we have a plate and we're pushing down on it from the top and bottom.
All right, I'm picturing it.
In a normal plate without a crack, the material compresses evenly, right? Like squeezing a sponge, it gets a bit shorter and wider.
Exactly. But in a plate with a crack, those crack lips, even if they're touching, they can't compress the same way the rest of the material does.
Because they're basically free surfaces, not connected to the surrounding materials in the same way, right?
Exactly. So when you push down on that plate, the crack lips want to move, maybe rotate, slide past each other, or even open up a bit.
So the crack is disrupting the normal flow of stress and doing its own thing.
Precisely. And to keep those lips from moving too much and potentially causing the crack to grow, the material has to push back harder. And that's what creates those higher contact stresses.
So it's like the material is compensating for the crack, working overtime in those areas to keep everything together.
You got it. And the stiffer the material, the stronger that pushback will be, leading to even higher contact stresses.
This is fascinating. Up to this point, we've mostly talked about cracks in plates. But cracks can form in all sorts of shapes and geometries, right?
Well, absolutely. Cracks can show up in all kinds of structures, from simple beams and columns to much more complex 3D shapes. And the geometry of the crack itself, its length, depth, shape, and orientation, all of that affects how it acts under stress.
So the shape of the crack is like a blueprint for how it'll respond to stress.
That's a great way to put it. For instance, think about a crack in a curved surface, like the inside of a pipe. That curvature is going to affect how the stress is spread around the crack and how it might grow.
It seems like crack geometry adds a whole other level of complexity to fracture mechanics.
It definitely does. And this is why understanding the basics of fracture mechanics is so important. It lets engineers predict how cracks will behave in different situations and design structures that can handle those forces safely.
This deep dive has been incredible. It's really opened my eyes to this hidden world of cracks and stresses.
It is a pretty fascinating world, isn't it? And we've only just begun to explore it. In the next part of our deep dive, we'll get into more detail about those stress intensity factors and how they're used to predict crack growth and ensure structural integrity.
Stay tuned. There are still plenty of secrets to uncover in the world of cracks and stresses. Welcome back to the deep dive. We've been on this awesome journey through the world of cracks and stresses, and now it's time to tackle the big one, stress intensity factors.
You're right. Those stress intensity factors, or SIFs for short, they're super important for understanding and predicting how cracks behave. They give us a way to actually measure the risk of a crack growing and make sure our structures are safe.
We talked about SIFs a bit before, saying they measure how intense the stress is near a crack tip. But let's dig a little deeper. What are they really, and how do engineers use them in the real world?
A stress intensity factor basically tells you how much that crack wants to grow. It's a measure of the stress concentration right at the tip of the crack.
So a higher SIF means the crack is under more stress and more likely to spread.
Exactly. Think of it like a measure of the crack's eagerness to grow. The cool thing about SIFs is that they let us predict how a crack will react to different loads and forces.
So it's a predictive tool. We can use it to see how a crack will behave in different situations.
Precisely. And that's incredibly valuable for engineers. It helps them design safe structures and figure out how long a component will last before it needs to be fixed or replaced.
Now, we've talked about those different modes of loading, mode I, mode 2, and mode 3. Do we have different stress intensity factors for each of those modes?
Yep, you got it. We have three main SIFs, one for each of those primary modes. We use KI for mode I, KI for mode 2, and K3 for mode 3.
So we're breaking down the crack's eagerness to grow into three parts, each one showing a different way the crack could grow.
Perfect analogy. By looking at each of these SIFs, we get a much better understanding of how the crack is behaving and what forces are driving its growth.
Earlier, we mentioned how those classical LEFM solutions, the ones that sometimes predict impossible things like those overlapping crack lips, can also give us negative stress intensity factors.
You're right, and those negative SEFs are a clear sign that the model is off track. They're basically saying that the stress is trying to push the crack closed, which doesn't make sense in the real world.
Right. It's like the model is pretending that cracks can magically heal themselves.
Exactly. Those negative SEFs are a big red flag. They tell us we need to fix our model and include things like contact stresses and friction between the crack lips.
So those real-world constraints are super important for getting SEFs that actually mean something.
Absolutely. Once we account for those factors, we get SEFs that reflect what's really happening with a crack.
Okay, so now we know what stress intensity factors are, but how are they actually used in real-world engineering? What can we do with them?
One of the most important uses is predicting how cracks will grow over time.
So we can use EFs to basically see into the future of a crack.
Pretty much. To do this, engineers use something called crack growth laws. These laws link the rate at which a crack grows to its stress intensity factor.
So it's like a mathematical formula that says if the stress intensity factor doubles, the crack will grow twice as fast.
That's the basic idea, although the exact relationship can be more complicated depending on the material and the loading conditions. These crack growth laws are based on tons of experimental data and theoretical models, and they let engineers make really accurate predictions about how cracks will behave.
That's amazing. So by knowing the SEF right now, you can basically fast forward and see how the crack will change in the future.
Exactly. That's super important for engineers. It helps them figure out how long a part will last, when it needs to be fixed or replaced, and how to design things that will last for their intended lifespan.
It sounds like SEFs are key to making sure things stay safe and reliable. Are there any other ways they're used?
Absolutely. Another critical application is in something called fracture toughness testing.
Fracture toughness. That's one of those material properties we talked about, right? The ability to resist crack growth.
You got it. To figure out a material's fracture toughness, engineers do special tests where they put a controlled crack in a sample and then apply a specific load.
So they're intentionally making a crack grow and seeing how much stress the material can handle before things get out of control.
Exactly. By measuring the load at which the crack starts growing rapidly, they can calculate the material's fracture toughness. This is often expressed as a critical stress intensity factor, which is basically the SEF at which the crack becomes unstable and starts growing like crazy.
So it's like a safety limit for cracks.
That's a good way to put it. Knowing this critical SEF is super important for engineers because it tells them how much stress a material can take before a crack becomes a major problem.
This has been an awesome deep dive. We've explored the basics of fracture mechanics, learned about stress intensity factors and how they're used, and even seen how researchers are using complex math to model crack behavior.
It's been a wild ride through a really important and interesting field of engineering. And I hope you've learned that cracks aren't always the bad guys we think they are.
Right. We tend to think of cracks as signs that something's about to break.
Exactly. But cracks are a natural part of how materials behave, and they don't always lead to disaster. In fact, engineers often put cracks or notches in things on purpose to make them stronger and last longer.
So it's all about understanding how to work with cracks, not just being afraid of them. And it seems like fracture mechanics is giving us the tools to do just that.
You got it. Fracture mechanics is about using theoretical models, experiments, and engineering know-how to predict how cracks will act and design things that can handle the stress.
This deep dive has given me a whole new perspective. I'm starting to see cracks not just as flaws, but as a way to learn, innovate, and build things that are safer, more reliable, and more resilient.
Well said. It's been great exploring the world of fracture mechanics with you. And remember, there's always more to learn and discover out there.
That's for sure. Keep those curious minds working. Thanks for joining us on the deep dive. We'll catch you on our next adventure into the world of science and engineering.